everyone. This is Henrik Palmgren from the Land of the Goths. Good to have you here. Hope you had an excellent week so far. You are listening to an independent radio program within a new emerging anti-establishment, anti-globalist, pro-European field that is developing within the poisoned West as an attempt to salvage and remedy those things that are worth saving and then build on that as the rest of the ship is going down. RedIce.tv is the new website. Also check out RedIceMembers.com for the full show. Archives all the way back to our start and all our video material, including our upcoming weekly live show that we'll be doing for members starting now in late May, maybe early June. We have a few more kinks to work out. I keep saying this, but I want to make sure that everyone hears it. Thank you so much to everyone who donated to us during our 10-year anniversary live show. Thank you. We have managed to acquire some new gear, including being able to take things mobile. I've just not had the time to send a personal thank you email to each and every one of you, so I want to make sure that you know how grateful we are for all your help and support. Now, another reason why it's been so busy is that just a few days ago, we spoke with Jared Taylor from American Renaissance, and we will be doing some live streams from the Ameren Conference this year in Tennessee. It's this weekend, May 20th to the 22nd, and we literally just found out a few days ago, so we've been rushing to transform everything into a mobile rig. Well, more or less mobile. Not an easy thing to do, but we are getting there. Still have a few additional tests to make before we are 100% confident that it will work the way we want it to work. So, as you might understand, it's been a few hectic days here, but we're going to put more information both on redice.tv/live and redicemembers.com/live as soon as we can. We are looking at doing one live stream on Friday evening, Eastern Standard Time, probably around 7 p.m. or so. Then on the Saturday, we'll do a couple, possibly three, one at lunch, 12:20 to 2:20, another one around 5 to 6:30, and then possibly an additional one starting an hour or so after that. So, you know, keep in mind that these times might change. We will do things very much on the fly, to be honest, and we'll have to wing it quite a bit. We found out late and we've been rushing to get just a technical aspect together. So, you know, it'll be more fun and laid back. We'll be talking with some of the speakers a bit. We might show some of the speeches. We haven't actually decided that yet. And, you know, pretty much anyone who wants to come by while we live stream. So youtube.com/redeyesradio is where you'll quickly see our live stream events as we add them in and start them up. So make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel to be alerted about that. But as I said, we will put information on the websites and we will embed the live streams there as well. So you will be able to catch them on the websites. All right, well, let's switch over to our show here today with those announcements out of the way. Tough Love is an artist and a blogger from New Zealand who writes from a Eurocentric perspective on his blog Tough Love Letters. In his life offline, he makes regular solo exhibitions and paintings that deal with abstract language and the history of Western painting. He has been making art since he was very young and pursued it at a tertiary level, which led to technical and teaching positions within the field. Now, recently, he has turned his attention towards the notion of art activism from a new right perspective that aims at taking the tools of the left-dominated art institutions and turning them back on themselves. Here we go. Tough Love, welcome back. Good to have you back on the show again. And by the way, for those who missed it, of course, you were part of our Down Under special with a few of the other guys from Australia. You were our New Zealand point man, so it's good to have you back again.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was heaps of fun doing that show, and I got a lot of good response from it. I've made some good connections with some great people, and I hope that this podcast is going to be even more fun.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Thanks. And that's good. That means we have some good folks listening in New Zealand and Australia as well. And I bet you there's probably other people too. But we didn't really get a chance to talk about some of your art and your study of art history last time. And I thought that this would obviously be a good opportunity to do that, to cover some of that and talk about some stuff that you write about on your blog, but also some new stuff really that I know that you wanted to go into today. So obviously art, I think, is a extremely powerful and important weapon to have in our arsenal to fight pretty much most of what we're seeing developing in the West these days, so-called progress, which, well, in reality is regress. So it's a degenerative process that is really eroding the little structure that we have left. But maybe you can first talk with us about your past as an artist and some of the things that you've kind of gone through and your own development in terms of art.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the place that we're at today in the art world is very, I mean, it really mirrors the rest of society in large. It's a really confusing place that we're at, and I think that, you know, normal everyday people don't really get it. But it's really interesting to look back through history from today and see how we got to where we are today. And in a way, my journey as an artist, it kind of mirrors that in a lot of ways. And so it's quite there's some quite interesting parallels. In general, there's a lot, the confusion around art and abstract art in particular is not only in the general public, but it's definitely in the new right, understandably so. So I hear a lot about how abstract art is a joke, and that, you know, it's a Jewish conspiracy and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And while there might be a lot of truth to some of that, I think that it's interesting to zoom into it a bit more and get more of a feel for actually what was going on in these periods when these works were made, and how that can actually be used today. So in terms of myself, when I was a little kid, I've got photos of myself sitting at my drawing table. I always had a setup in my room with pens and pencils and paper. I was always the kid at school who was the art guy. So kids would always get me to draw pictures for them, or if there was something that needed to be done for the class, then I would be given the task of drawing whatever it was. I followed that through high school, but that was when things started to become a little unstuck, because what happens in high school in New Zealand anyway, at the time that I was a student, was that you would study famous artists, but the way that they get you to study it was to copy the paintings.
Really?
or copy the style of the paintings. So in a sense, we were making duplicates or variations of what was essentially the end result of a process that the artist got through to paint a painting. So the actual way that the artist got to where they're at, or what they were actually trying to consider when they made the painting, wasn't even really addressed. So it was quite an artificial way of doing things. And even at the time, I remember it confusing me. But then when you get out of high school and then you're faced with what you're going to do after that, there was no university in my town that was offering a fine arts degree. And so I went to more of a sort of independent community-based institution for a couple of years. And what happens at places like that, you know, there's a real divide here between university and the more kind of like community courses, is that at university you're taught avant-garde practice. So you're taught the cutting edge of art as a discipline. Whereas at these other places, you're more taught technique.
Mm-hmm, right.
So you're taught, you know, how to paint a still life. You're taught how to mix color, you know, basic rules of composition. So it's much more of a kind of crafty, cozy sort of dabble, you know, you sort of dabble in different things. You try a little bit of this and you try a little bit of that. And in a sense, that was actually really good, because I didn't get overloaded with a whole bunch of critical theory when right. My brain was very young. You know, what's happening is that students are going into university straight out of high school, and they're just getting, they've got no life experience, and they're getting bombarded with papers that they absorb and they read with theory, and then art kind of gets made out of that.
Horrible. And I learned, horrible.
And I learned this when there was a fine arts course that was started up in my town. So after the sort of more community-based thing, I went into the university system. And I was in my late 20s by then, so I had some life experience. And I was one of the older students. There were sort of three or four of us who were heading into our 30s, and the rest of the students were 18 or 19 years old,
right,
straight out of high school.
Yeah.
And I got really disillusioned really quickly, and I didn't actually really know why at the time. I just saw that kids were coming in as painters and drawers, and they were leaving as video artists and performance artists. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. It was the way that theory was getting applied to practice. This is in hindsight, I've realized.
Of course.
That, yeah. Yeah. That was the problem. And
so at the time you were like, hey, this is awesome. Or what was your attitude at the time?
Well, the first year that you go in, it was pretty hands on. You were doing drawing studio and you know, pretty hands on stuff, and I was excelling in these areas where it was actually a lot like the community kind of based courses that I did. You just go in and there's a setup on the table, and today you're using paint and charcoal and you just go for it. And that was great. But then once you move into the second year, then that's where it really starts. You really start getting hit with the readings and stuff, and the critical theory. and then I didn't really last past. I sort of got a term into the second year, and then I was like, you know what? This just is not sitting right with me, and I just bailed.
Yeah.
And I remember after that, sitting at home at a table with a wine bottle and an orange and a fucking bowl of flowers on the table and some paints, and I'm sitting there and I'm making a painting. This is just purely because it's what I want to do. And I remember sitting there and going, but what's the point? Like,
right.
What am I doing? What relevance does this have to anything?
Yeah.
Am I just painting a pretty picture that is going to make someone go, oh, that's nice, and then that's it? And I actually resolved to give up at that point. Just give up. I was like, well, university is not doing it for me. I don't see any point in what I'm doing here. So to hell with it. And I just made an actual conscious decision then to just stop, which is pretty sad.
Yeah.
Considering it was something I'd done naturally my whole life.
So it was really ruined for you then in that way, right? Did too much maybe analytical processes got in the way there of just creativity maybe?
Both systems had failed me. The community-based course was all kind of like technique with no theory. And then the university course, it was almost like it was all theory with no technique in a way.
Right.
And I couldn't, I didn't have the skills to resolve the two. But then a couple of years later, I realized that I was going to go mad if I didn't do something, you know, get back into it. I realized that I couldn't not do it. And a bunch of really sort of fortuitous circumstances led me towards a course that's still offered here in New Zealand that I got a scholarship to. And I was kind of just doing it because I was like, well, I've got to do something and I'm getting a scholarship to do this, so why not? And it turned out that this course put the two irresolvable differences together.
Mm.
And so through studying there, I went on to be a technician for the studio. Then I actually taught the course for a couple of years. And then when I had my fill, I left, and I've been generating my own art practice ever since, with still a lot of questions and confusion, which I think is never going to go away, but with a conviction that I never had before. Running parallel to that is getting into, you know, kind of conspiracy stuff at the same time. So I remember a friend introducing me to David Icke and really getting into, you know, that whole world that's there. You know it well, Henrik.
Oh, yeah.
But then coming through into the alt-right or the new right, and that causing me to re-question everything that I'd learned in art before.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at a point where it it needs to go somewhere where it's actually gonna take it on a new tack and hopefully help the situation that we're in today in some way.
Well, I think this is important because I think at least with the view on the history of art, there's an incredible amount to learn there and also to use, as I said in the beginning, as a weapon in our battle in many ways. I think it's just in more recent terms, and we can get into this discussion whether, you know, modern art is all bad or if there is some stuff there that we still can utilize. But I become so jaded with art because, frankly, of all the reasons you mentioned, that all the art is pretty much the same. It's all about, pushing the envelope, making it radical, breaking all the what they perceive to be these boundaries that has to be broken all the time. And it's just not much there anymore, to be honest.
Absolutely. I can't even really try and keep up with it too much because it's just too, I mean, not only is there just so much going on at the moment, but it is really disheartening and aggravating at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole art world today is so hard left, it beggars belief. It's really just mirroring. It's really just mirroring the Western world.
Yeah.
At large, but it really is a kind of like visual tool to chip away at the traditional West. It's just like locusts, just ripping little chunks off it and just taking it down from its own side of the field. You know, the art world is huge and it's a huge industry. And a lot of artists, I think that they just think that they're actually doing something good and that they're helping by critiquing this and critiquing that. They don't actually realize that they're actually making art to seal their own fate.
Right.
To be blunt about it. But the thing is, where I'm coming from is that I have had the education that I've had and I have made the work that I've made. And I think that there are some really valuable things to absorb from the history of art through modernism and through postmodernism. And in a large sense, I don't think that we can actually go back to some sort of golden era of classical, art making, where it's polished representation of these amazing, elaborate scenes with the most brilliant techniques of tonal modulation and composition. That would be just going back.
Right.
And to go forward, we need to understand how we got to where we are today, because actually our vision as a society at large is soaked in this history. We can't separate out how we see and what's happened through art practice through the years. And so as far as I'm concerned, there's really no way out and there's really no way of avoiding it. For me as an artist, I need to confront it and actually turn it back on itself using its language before I can get to anywhere meaningful. That maybe has any resemblance to the great period of the past.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, it's both sad, but it's understandable that we just can't. I don't think we're hardwired that way to just go backwards, you know.
That's right.
I don't think it's good either, to be honest. But what's interesting is, it has come through in other types of related fields, I guess, whatever you want to call it. I remember one fashion photographer, I think his name was David LaChapelle or something, if I remember him correctly. And he basically, you know, there was a documentary I saw by his technique and stuff. And he basically just opened like a Renaissance art book, you know, and just flicked through and just like, oh, that looks good. And then just basically recreated the scenes in that. And everyone just loved his photography. It was like groundbreaking, they said, or something, you know. But it's like, well, okay, he just used old techniques, you know, and just used these same old kind of classical motifs and whatever. So I think that's what it's really about. It's about taking what we know from that period and maybe trying to take that into the future. But that maybe that's easier said than done in these days.
It's really easier said than done, and the stakes are very high. I mean, the way that I look at art and art history is really from an artist's perspective. So when I was in high school, for example, and I was taking art history courses, we were looking back over history, and we were learning about the circumstances surrounding the making the work of art. So we learned a bit about the life of the artist. We learned a bit about maybe the political situation. We learned a little bit about composition of the painting. But for me, I was never that engaged in it. There was always something missing. I felt like I wasn't actually getting to the heart. I wasn't getting to the heart of the painting itself, the actual object, and what it was doing. And it wasn't until I had my most sort of recent education that I realized that there's actually another criteria for which to assess what artists were doing, that you can sort of look at from as far back as you want to go until today, and it actually makes it make sense. And that is, and this relates to a blog post that I did recently, a dialogue, excuse my university terminology, please, a dialogue between art and life,
mm-hmm.
or making art real. So posing the question, what, and I use the example of painting a lot because painting is sort of like the model for everything that's happened in art practice, even till today. You know, you can draw a direct relationship between painting and the computer screen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What can a painting do that nothing else can? So if I sit here with a stretch canvas and some paints, and I've got my wine bottle and my orange and my vase of flowers on the desk, and I'm mixing my colors to mimic the light effects of the surfaces of the objects, and I'm recreating that on a two-dimensional surface, I'm using painting to mimic reality. So the painting is not the thing. It's coming secondary. So when the viewer looks at the artwork, they're looking at something that came before, which was the real objects and real space.
Mm-hmm, right.
So the painting is a result of the artist looking at the real world and then recording it onto a 2D surface. Now, when you look pre-photography, that's painting doing something that nothing else can, because there were no other means of capturing a likeness of something. It was the only thing that you could use to do it. So painting was real in that sense.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so you've got this sort of trajectory where, like in medieval times, it wasn't so much making things look like how they really looked in real life. It was more about stylized figures and words to convey a spiritual message. So a literal likeness, like a photographic likeness of something, was not important. But then, as things become more sophisticated and a kind of scientific worldview starts coming in, things like perspective are invented, so that the painting makes real, say, a theme from antiquity or from the Bible. So before, it was in a book and you had to read the scripts and imagine it in your head. Whereas now artists were using these sophisticated techniques of tonal modulation and perspective to make the painting a logical extension of real space. And they were painting them on architecture and on a large scale. So figures could be almost life-size. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to actually tear open a void with the painting where the viewer can stand in the present moment in front of the narrative that is trying to be articulated. So painting is trying to become a real experience for the viewer standing there, instead of having to conjure up the images in their head.
There's an interesting thing that obviously came to me while you're talking about this, but we'll save that for later. So keep going.
Well, I mean, if the listeners think about the, or can Google the Sistine Chapel, so you've got the vaulted ceiling of the chapel has been dissolved. There's no solid architecture there anymore, except for the kind of supporting beams. The flat surface of that structure has been literally opened up to the heavens. So you look up, and the artist has created a logical extension of space, vortexing, say, into the heavens with all of these characters, some of them sort of like sitting on the real architecture, you know, interacting with the real space of the chapel. But this is an experience that the viewer couldn't have any other way to make these myths have become as real as they could possibly come in a visual experience. So, remembering that this is pre a machine that can capture a perfect likeness of reality. So it really is if you try to put yourself in that time, painting really is this beast that is becoming more and more dramatic and unlike anything that's come before and unlike anything that anything else can do. Save, I don't know. Well, you know, the technology's not there. I was going to say, like, you know, making people climb up onto the Sistine Chapel wrapped in robes and all sitting there in the poses. But then, how are you going to open up the ceiling to this vortex going into the heavens?
Right.
You haven't got special effects equipment to do that. So, yeah. So it really is being used as a tool to give the viewer a present and real experience, standing there at that moment, looking up, and probably trying to inspire within them. The point is to make their spirit align with it, so that they actually open up from the inside by having this immediate experience.
Yeah, because I mean, maybe that's also then one of the reasons why we just can't or will not return back to that era of artistry and really representation. I mean, it's, again, as you said, there's a layer on top of things which makes it more metaphysical and impossible to a certain extent. But as you say, if they were trying to achieve representation of accurately depicting something, then in these days, we have that so vividly, so accurate that even it even goes beyond what we can see with the real eye. When we look at 4K moving imagery on a screen, we can actually we'll have a more accurate representation of reality there than we can with our own eyes, right? So maybe that's one of the reasons why we just don't want to go there anymore. And it's almost like that the art itself is becoming more and more clouded to a certain extent, the more accuracy we can get in photography. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's become obsolete. You know, when you think today about how primitive painting is compared to the sophistication of the technology at our hands at the moment to, say, render images, then it's almost like, well, you know, probably these guys, like Michelangelo, probably if he was alive today, he wouldn't be using painting. I don't know, but he might be innovating with, you know, the latest stuff that's being put out by Apple. Who knows? But it's a really important point to come to terms with, because photography really is what flipped the whole thing on its head. So, you know, up until the 1800s, the boundaries between art and life were becoming smaller and smaller in terms of representation. So artists were beginning to put everyday figures into their work, so that when the viewer stood in front of the painting, they weren't looking at purely these scenes from antiquity that were existing in the past. They were looking at people that they knew around them, the type character types that were in their, say, their village or whatever, or their town. And so it was becoming, the subject matter was becoming present, more present moment. Biblical themes, like in the Baroque, say, with Caravaggio, it would have Christ and his disciples, but the disciples would be like guys from that time, you know, wearing those sorts of clothes. But also the actual means of the representation were beginning to change as well. Like, things were becoming less polished. Paint texture was becoming more accentuated. So the actual material itself, light source was beginning to be played with. So instead of the painting being lit by some illusionary sun that was outside the work in the sky, you know what I mean? Like, you've got a scene of, say, Greek columns with some guys standing in a square, and they're all lit from one angle so that you've got shadow on the one side and light on the other. But the actual light source of that is beyond the boundary of the painting, and in this kind of illusory world where the sun's in some illusionary painted sky. Whereas in the Baroque, say with Caravaggio, you're actually getting these weird light sources where the figures are almost lit from inside the painting. So they might be sitting around a table, and the light source is almost coming from the center of the work. So they're being so all around them is blackness. Like if people think of a painting like Doubting Thomas, there's blackness surrounding the figures who are lit from a central point. And so there's no illusionary light source coming from outside the work itself. It's actually coming from within the painting. My point is, what this is actually doing is that it's alluding to that there's nothing outside the work, that the whole drama is happening within those four sides of the canvas, in front of the viewer. There's no illusionary world that goes outside of it anymore.
Right.
So these things are really important to understand because they're refining this kind of idea that painting's not coming secondary to anything anymore. It's generating its own meaning from the inside. There's a great movie called Mr. Turner, which is about the life of William Turner, that I recommend everyone watches. It came out a couple of years ago, and there's a scene in there where he walks into a photography studio, and it's like the first photography studio in his town. This is when it's cutting edge and it's come over from America, and he sits there and he has his photo taken, and he says something to the effect of, pretty soon I can see that artists are going to be taking this little box out into the landscape and taking a photo of it that's going to do a far better job of depicting reality than any painter can do. Mm-hmm. Essentially saying that painting will be obsolete
right.
from this box. But But actually what we see in the invention of photography is a catalyst for almost an inversion of everything that's gone before. And we're still coming to terms with today in a lot of ways in the art world. And so this is where the discussion really gets interesting. The problem is that I'm aware how quickly time goes by, and there are so many details that that we can go into and so many interesting things. And so it's important to try and keep the discussion quite broad. So So Henrik, if you you know, have any questions that you want to ask to sort of keep the discussion firmly on track, go for gold, or I can just keep going.
Well, let me ask you, and you can be brief on this if you think we should head on from here, but obviously this is kind of rhetorical, but so is it photography's fault that we went from the Sistine Chapel with the likes of, you know, Brunelleschi and Michelangelo to Duchamp's fountain, that urinal that he exhibited, you know?
In a lot of ways, yes. I mean, it's really within the broader context of industrialization and mechanization. So what you get is we've still got this question of what can painting do, or what can art do that nothing else can? Once the camera's here, well, it can reproduce reality. So if painting's role is no longer to reproduce reality, then what is it?
Mm-hmm, right.
What can it do to still actually maintain a kind of relevance that photography can't do? And this is where we enter modernism. And a way that I really keep myself grounded with what is modernism is just a really simple way that I'm sure the listeners will understand, is that if you just think of modernism as opposed to traditionalism, if you think of the modern world, the idea of a modern world as opposed to a traditional one. And in a lot of ways, the way this manifested in the arts was a kind of erosion of the modes of, say, aesthetic production that came traditionally before. This was happening in music as well, and it was happening in writing. So the very hierarchical structures that dictated what constitutes a painting or what constitutes a piece of music or a piece of writing were almost turned back in on themselves and kind of flattened, but the hierarchy was sort of being leveled out. And we can see this literally as we track through the 20th century, that art became like a literal visual manifestation of the dismantling of traditional hierarchies. So when you look at photography and you look at how painting responded, what you're getting is you're getting a dismantling of the structures that make painting represent a three-dimensional space on a 2D surface. Photography can do that now. Photography can become a logical extension of space into the horizon line. It can deal with tonal modulation perfectly to render a three-dimensional object on a 2D surface. Once color comes along, it can handle color too. So what's a painting? Well, a painting is a rectangle or a square. It is a flat surface. It is liquid pigments from a palette mixed and put onto that surface. It is material color. It's line, it's plane, and all of these things have a job. All of these things have a traditional job that have been used to create a classical painting. And so this really bizarre, all of these really bizarre art forms that we see, like if you think of Impressionism, which I think a lot of viewers today still actually see as traditional. You know, a lot of people who criticize modern art might, from today's point of view, see Impressionism as linking with the great Western works of a bygone era. But, you know, at the time, Impressionism was very much sneered upon. It was seen as degenerate. It was seen as crude, as primitive, and all those sorts of things. You've got Cubism, which takes it even further. Pure abstract art, where, you know, like geometric abstract art. And if you look at those things, I mean, even if you just go from Impressionism, I'm sure that most people know what a Monet looks like. If you take a Monet, if you take a Picasso, and if you take a Mondrian, you can see this complete exclusion of the illusion of depth, of any identifiable object, of any representation of an object, you know, if you look at a Mondrian, where's the hierarchy in a Mondrian? You've got primary colors, like unmixed, say, primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. You've got them in fairly, well, they're not equal distribution of color, but they're in squares or rectangles. And then you've got white and black, you know, lines, I would reluctantly call them. So the squares of the work are mirroring the squares of the canvas support. And they all just kind of sit there really flat. And you think, well, what's the meaning there? Like, what am I possibly supposed to derive from this?
Right.
If you look at it through the lens of the closing of the window of tradition, so this beautiful seamless space that goes from the viewer's feet back into this canvas, you know, across a courtyard that's been painted of some great golden era of the past, with a building in the background, then through over the hills to a horizon line, and then a lovely sunset with some clouds. Mondrian closed that shut because he's saying, "Well, what can my painting do that this camera can't?" I'm simplifying here. And so he's given you like the building blocks of a painting. He's just he's just got rid of all extraneous content, and like it's a reductionism. He's reduced it down to like the bare elements of what a painting can be. If you go and you look at what his philosophy was behind this, well, it's this thing he calls like dynamic equilibrium or neoplasticity or whatever it is. And his basic thing is making a painting where no element dominates, where the different proportions of the colors and the lines and the planes are distributed in such a way where there's no, where the push and the pull, where the fighting between them is settled down to a kind of almost inactivity. And if you look at this in terms of like egalitarianism, for example, I mean, it's almost like a perfect mirror. It's trying to create a model that does away with a hierarchical society and gives you an egalitarian one. Hmm. Whether you want to call that communism or whether you want to call that like social democracy. So these things, I'm just explaining it in one way, but in a large way, this is why you get these really bizarre and almost like meaningless art forms happening in the 20th century.
Well, this is really then when art has become weaponized. I mean, of course, it goes back earlier than that. But you could argue that during the Renaissance, these religious Christian motifs was kind of used as a form of propaganda as well. Obviously, you can do that, but what I'm trying to get to is to say that now art has become a political tool. It has become didactic and, in effect, also then lost its role, its traditional role. I mean, sure, these days they say, oh, well, art is there to break the boundaries or whatever, but I don't think that this was the case historically. I think art was actually there to affirm identity and purpose. I mean, take what tribal art of old European societies. I mean, that was there to strengthen the group, to kind of underline the mythology of the identity of those people. Today, it's there to break down and to weaken. This has truly become part of the culture of critique, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a really interesting area in this idea of art being a propaganda tool for the state, where the two are in line and artists are getting commissioned. They've got a job painting for the people in power to present a picture of whatever it is that that they want the viewers to absorb. And then when you get into this kind of like revolution stage, like with the French Revolution or like the Paris Commune of 1848 or whatever it was, and then through into the 20th century, it is like whenever there's kind of like a left wing government in, the art is used to destroy the any sort of more right wing threats. But then, yeah, I mean, when there's a right wing government in, say, art is used for when there's a right wing government in, I mean, yeah, I don't know enough about the particulars of history to really say, but it's almost like art almost like supports, like it tries to grow something, whereas when the left are in, art tries to degenerate something.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's not that black and white, but from my point of view, I'm not sure where I actually stand on that. Like maybe I take a third position. This is what I'm actually trying to come to grips with now.
Well, you know, what's funny here though, and I mean, this could kind of, I'm not saying we're there yet, but this could initiate the conversation on how we can use art as a weapon in our struggle, if you will. But if it's there to break things down and break rules and attack the establishment, well, let's adopt that now then, right? Because now they are in charge, right? They have broken everything down to the point where they run the show pretty much. So let's adopt their modalities in a way.
Yeah. No, that's right. And I mean, so if we keep leading the listeners into how we are today, we can actually just keep going through the 20th century and just see what the famous painters, you know, I mean, the people that we still revere today were dealing with. And I know that there's a danger of giving like kind of a really linear historical account of things, like this happened, because not only does it oversimplify things, that actually things were happening before other things. Like there's no general, there's no absolute general trend. There's always anomalies that pop up before other things. Things weave back on themselves. And also, of course, artists at the time didn't know what was coming next. Yeah, they were breaking the rules of their fathers, but they didn't have the ability to predict the future. And so when we look back, we've got to keep in mind that we need to judge the artworks on the time, like try and put ourselves there, realizing that we don't know what we know today. Because for us, like an Andy Warhol, it's like, oh yeah, whatever. But that's because our culture has become so saturated with what pop art did that we can't see the wood for the trees anymore. Whereas if you take yourself back to a time where this shit didn't exist, then you can kind of have maybe a new appreciation for it and more of an understanding about the actual significance, whether you think it was right or wrong or shit or not. Just at least have a bit more of an understanding, because it really does help us now and today. And so, I guess I just like to leap forward a bit to Jackson Pollock. And keeping in mind the lens through which we're viewing this, and that is asking the question, what can painting do that nothing else can, or what can art do that is its own thing and blurs the boundaries between art and life, like breaks down the structures, the divisions, the hierarchies that kept things separate in order to bring about something else, a new way of seeing. And artists all deal with this on different levels. Some were very ideological and utopian, so they had this vision that if you can expose the essence of what a painting is, you will see the face of God, which is ridiculous,
right?
But admirable in its earnestness, or a work of art can become a model for a kind of communist utopia. Or if you look at Russian constructivism, that the boundaries between the art object and utility can become dismantled, so that there's no actual difference between the art object and its function and what the average worker needs, for example, like art on a practical level aids the efficiency of a new communist utopia, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we're keeping these things in mind. Jackson Pollock, when we're looking at this kind of tearing down of hierarchy, now I don't know, you know, also artists do things sometimes and they don't actually mean, or a lot of the time an artist will make a painting and they don't mean, like, the meaning of the painting when they've made it isn't the meaning that they started with. So you put an artwork out into the world and you might have meant it to be a really angry work, and then people might come to it and go, oh, this is really, you know, passionate, or I actually feel really happy off of this work. So your intention can only go so far.
Does that mean they're a bad artist and they can't really express what they want to express then?
No, it doesn't. What it means is that you're working with unknowns. So you're putting into action parameters that you're trying to push, and then what the artwork is something that you could not have predicted. So you're actually giving the work room to breathe and have its own life.
Sure.
And take things forward. Because, like, let's remember, like art from other cultures, it's fairly static. I'm talking about traditional. So there's not really much innovation. They have these ways of like carving or painting, making designs and things that serve the purpose. But when you look at them in contrast with Western practice, like avant-garde practice, it's just moving forward all the time. You know, whether you go back to the 13th century and you look at the breakthroughs in perspective and tonal modulation and you know, the ability to render the real world on a 2D surface, it's just constantly pushing these boundaries. So when you come to Jackson Pollock, well, I don't know whether anyone's seen the movie of him with Ed, what's his name? There's a great scene at the beginning where he's being like escorted up to his apartment by a friend of his. Pollock's absolutely like just deliriously drunk, and he can't even walk up the stairs, and his friend's helping him up, and he collapses on the sort of landing of the stairwell, and he just launches into this little diatribe about fucking Picasso, like everywhere I turn, there is Picasso. As in, what he's saying is, he's not saying that he hates Picasso. He's actually loves Picasso so much that he's become trapped, because everything that Jackson Pollock was working with at the time was this kind of expressionist version of Picasso. Like everything he tried to do to break the rules and to create a new language in painting, he came up against Picasso because Picasso had already done it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
And then you go and you look at his drip paintings. Now, I know a lot of people just think that his drip paintings are just like a joke.
Right. A three-year-old could do that, right?
A three-year-old could do that. It's just splatters on a surface. This is just taking the piss. This is throwing art back in the faces of the viewer. Yet it's being sold for millions and millions and millions of dollars. What the fuck? And I totally get that. But aside from what you think about it, you've got to see it in terms of its importance of getting us to where we are today. And I'll just hit on this really briefly, in that the job of the tools of painting, still in Picasso in a lot of ways, are that, you know, you've got color that gets painted as a plane that is bounded by a line. No matter how abstract the work, this is still the job of these different elements in a painting. Whereas when Pollock dips his stick into a can of house paint and he lets it fall from the stick and gravity take it down to the surface, then you've got no plane anymore. And the line, which is the drip, and the color are the same thing. So he's collapsed the boundaries between these different elements of painting. When it falls to the floor, it's more like a mat than a work. So traditionally, artists, no matter how, even Mondrian, he's still working with his painting on an easel. He's still got it up, mirroring the world in some way. Like he has to use a paintbrush in order to move his paint from a palette on the tabletop up through space onto a vertical surface and make it stay there. Whereas Pollock's eliminated that. Like he's not fighting against gravity anymore. The paint is falling down with the physical force that dictates everything else in the universe, if you want to look at it like that. So when these thick skeins of paint get layered up and layered and layered up on this huge surface, when that goes on the wall, you're looking, not only are you looking at something that's really flat, like the paint falling and drying is maintained in that work that's now vertical on the wall. So you try to look at it as an illusion, as a cloud, as an atmosphere, as a landscape even. Like your visual perception is trying to make it look like an illusion, but the sheer physicality of its making and gravity being a part of that is holding out against your ability to do that. So you're kind of pinging between it's real, it's an illusion, it's real, it's an illusion, it's real, it's an illusion. But more importantly almost is that this is where, and this is for the understanding where we are today, this is where process comes into painting, as in it's the process, it's the repeated process of painting that's generated the meaning of the work itself. So gravity has subjected the material of the paint to its own materiality. It doesn't transform the paint into something else. It's maintained its own sort of integrity in that way. So when you look at that through the lens of art and the boundaries between art and life collapsing, well, you've now brought in the physical universe. Like the actual physical universe is now having a major dictating role in what makes the work of art, the form that the work of art takes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's the question is if it's like, is it meant to be, the word apophenia, right? That you kind of, you perceive meaningful patterns within random shapes and stuff, right? And the question is that the achievement? Because I heard a pretty interesting, it was an Indian guy, I forget his first name, it was Ramachandran or something, and he started psychology, but like brain waves and stuff like this, synapse flow and things like this, and he did studies on art and how human brains reacted to art. And his way was like almost more mathematical. He basically said, if your brain is firing when you're looking at something, then it's good art. You know, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter. It's good art if your brain is like trying to figure things out, right? That's why it was like, so according to his method, it was like, that's why Picasso were like, you know, an eyeball is kind of off to the side and the nose is unproportionate and almost two-dimensional. When that happens, your brain is trying to like figure it out, right? It's trying to piece it together. And he said, that's what it's all about. You know, I don't know if you would agree with that, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty interesting one. I think that that's kind of a given in when a viewer looks at an artwork. That's part of the game that artists are involved with. That's part of the game that artists who are involved in this language are aware of when they're making a work. So it's almost like you know that the viewer is going to try to control your painting into something that they can recognize from the outside world.
Yeah.
It just seems to be a basic way that we perceive. And so an artist, when they make, like an abstract artist, when they make a painting, it's almost like they're working against the viewer to put pressure on that propensity to control the work into something. And through putting pressure on it, you're hopefully opening up something else to happen, where you're denying them that that ability to do that, but through that, because a work is very easily dismissed, like an abstract painting is very easily dismissed, when a viewer can look at it and they can go, for sure, oh yeah, that looks like you know, a landscape. I can see that plane there is like the foreground, and then that was the background. Then we've got this atmospheric illusion going off into distance. Once a viewer has felt that they've controlled it, then they move on.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can deny them that to a point, then they can't control it, and so you can almost catch them so that they can't resolve it. And I think that a work of art works best when it can't be resolved, when the viewer is constantly in a process of negotiation of the painting, to make everything fit, but there's something in there that they haven't seen before or whatever, and then that. Yeah,
but that can be the event itself too, right? It doesn't have to be the composition or the way that you've put the piece together. It could be, you know, you can look at an image of, or an image, a painting of, you know, a king or something that has been shot from the 1500s, you know, or 1600s or something. And there's tons of different things going on in there, but people return to it and look at it again and again because they, I mean, obviously, as you say, this is part of it, that you project your stuff onto it. You allow the artwork to become a part of you. You're letting it in to a certain extent. And the more you find in it, so to speak, the better it will become to you. That's kind of a given, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of hold this view that the appeal of a work of art, like say we go back to a painting from the Renaissance, for example, that we can marvel at a particular painting, for example. But my question is, what is it about that painting that is making you marvel? Like, is it the narrative? Is it actually the particular story that's being told with these figures in the work? Or can we interchange those figures with other figures and you're still going to marvel? Because it's what the artist, it's what the painter has done with his paint. Like, it's the polish of the finish that he got on rendering those robes. Or that, you know, the quality of that flesh that he rendered, so you can almost reach out and touch it and it's going to feel like flesh. So it's the way that he's worked with his tools, with his means. It's the interaction between him and that surface that's generated that reaction in the viewer, where it's like, oh my God, you know, it takes your breath away.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I've got a collection of paintings at my place, and like landscapes, and it's not that that a particular painting represents a scene from the town that I grew up in. Like, that's a sentimental value. But if that painting was really badly painted by that rule, I'd still love it, because the meaning of it for me is that it depicts the town that I paint, that I came from. So,
right. Yeah.
So very rarely do people hang a work of art in their house purely because it just reminds them of something that they're sentimental towards. They hang it in their house because it does something. Like, the artist has actually gone through a process with his brush and his paints and the canvas, where the result is this thing that you just go, yeah, like, yes. There's something in it, and I maintain that it's that engagement. It's the way that it's the relationship that they've had with their material and the process of how it's got onto the thing. It doesn't matter whether it's a vase of flowers, a still life, a piece of history painting. It doesn't at the end of the day, it doesn't actually really matter. I mean, it does.
Right.
But not to the
person who appreciates it.
You've got to understand the difference, because the question is, where does the meaning lie? And well, if you have a photo of a monument in America, let's say, and then you have a painting of that monument, there's a difference between the two things. The similarity is that they're both depicting the same thing. But the difference is that the painting is painted with paint by a person who has had to do things with a brush to get it to look like it does. And he scrubs that brush on the surface to get it there, or he waters his paint down, he does it in thin washes, or he uses it thickly so that when you look at it, the light of the room is catching these brush strokes, and it is that, it's a touch, it relates to the body, you actually have a physical sensation of it when a painting is done really well.
I wanted to say as well, definitely finish that thought, but time is just running away from us here. We will need to take a break here soon. But before we do that, I wanted to just maybe introduce the topic briefly that we want to discuss more in the second. And because I do want to get into this aspect of how we can use art in our, kind of in our battles today. I think that's kind of the weight of all of this at the end of it. If there's something you want to wrap up on what we just talked about, please go ahead and do that first.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I guess in some ways, Pollock is a pretty good place to end section one, because he really is whether you like him or not, he's a pivotal point in art history, because of the fact that his paintings open up to process in art, and that is really a major shift that takes us into postmodernism and gets us to where we are today. So I encourage all the listeners who don't already have a membership to grab one and come over to Hour Two, because this is where we're going to really sharpen things up, and we're going to talk about where we are today and some tactics or some considerations for how we can actually, I'm talking about avant-garde practice here. I'm not talking about somebody who's making a product for a market. Like, if you paint nice landscapes and you're moving units to generate an income, which is your livelihood, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about taking a risk and actually trying to shift, trying to use art to turn back on the world that we're in today, and actually make a physical space and a physical manifestation that is going to kind of like support our cause. What I do want to do, extend now, is I want to just extend an invitation to anyone listening that, I'm going under a pseudonym right now, Tough Love. So I have a art life, which is under my real name, and I'm in a funny position at the moment, because if I go, like if someone Googles my name and they come across, say, this podcast, then that could deny me at the moment certain benefits that I'm trying to get at the moment, like residencies, grants, from an art institution that is entirely left wing.
So
there's no room for the views that get expressed on, say, Red Ice Radio.
So if I'm
linked to that, then you know, I go and apply for something, they Google my name, Red Ice Radio comes up, they listen, it's like blacklisted.
So
what I want to do is I don't know who's out there listening right now who listens to Red Ice Radio, who owns a gallery. There might be no one, or there might be a couple of people. It doesn't matter where they are. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, or you might even know of just a space that could be really cool. There might be artists out there who feel like they're at a point where they want to do something. So I encourage, please get hold of me, because I would love to come to where you are and make a series of work and show it. You know, at the moment, my practice is kind of divided. Like if none of what was going on in the world today was happening, I'd be making a kind of just like a slow release series of work. It would be, you know, it wouldn't be explicit. It would be working with traditions, but it's something that would happen over the course of a career. Whereas what we need now is we kind of need activism, because art's all about activism at the moment. Yeah. Everyone thinks they're critiquing this and that, and that they're social activists.
Right.
What we need is we need to start turning that back on itself. And so I'm proposing a certain line of work that is more in an art activist field, and it's revolving around hate speech. So I'd like to give a, you know, have an exhibition, make it real, put it in a space, document it, publicize it, get it online, offend a whole lot of people, hopefully. And also maybe, you know, give some moral support to the great things that that other people are doing in terms of, you know, politics, in terms of philosophy, and all the other things on the new right. So please, galleries, get hold of me. Please, interested parties, get hold of me. toughloveletters@gmail.com, or you can find my blog, which is, what is it, Hendrik? WordPress, Tough Love Letters, I think.
Yeah,
it's
toughloveletters.wordpress.com.
Thank you. Because I think that we should really make something happen and make something real. And I feel like I've got the experience to do it, and I've got the conviction to do it. So let's go.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the true counterculture thing to do in our times here. So there are a couple of things that you are working on right now, isn't that right?
Yeah. So I mean, I've got a few things on the go that are just more of my kind of normie projects, which I'm really wanting to kind of like wind down and transition to something that's really in line with you know, with my ideologies, I guess. And you know, I don't want to be going under a pseudonym much longer. So if I put on a show based on, say, hate speech, then I'm going under my real name. You know, I'll be photographed with my work. I'll be interviewed about the work. I'll do all those things. At the moment, I'm just, because of these things that I've got going on, I'm just protecting myself a little bit longer. But so this work based around hate speech, what it's attempting to do is it's attempting to bring together the self-referentiality of painting. So as in the kind of things that we've been talking about, like art turned back on itself. So what can a painting do that nothing else can? But bringing in these great memes and words that are growing every day, you know, in our culture, and making a kind of making a series of large scale works that walk the line between only referring to themselves, but actually referring to the situation of the world based on race, that's going on at the moment. It's hard for me to say much more than that because the work really does the job. So, and I'm not going to go put them on my blog. I'll talk about specific examples with anyone who contacts me because, of course, the form the work takes will depend on what country it's shown in, for example. Like the work I'd make for New Zealand, I would use very different words and very different processes than I would if it was in America, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely understand that. Well, okay, folks, go check out the blog, toughloveletters.wordpress.com. You have the email right there on the front page. And definitely do that. And I'm looking forward to continuing here our conversation and see a bit more here, some of the ideas that our guest has in terms of what we can do and how we can use art, in what way we should employ it to try to basically turn things around, to retrieve some form of sanity in the situation we're in. But stay with us then. We'll take a short break and then we'll be right back with more.
Softly in the evening dusk, a woman is singing to me. She takes me back down the vista of my years until I see a child underneath the piano and the boom of the tingling strings, pressing the poised feet of his mother, who smiles at him as she sings, cuckoo-doo-coo. Softly now in the evening dusk, a woman is singing to me, and she takes me back down the vista of my years until I see a boy, a child, underneath the piano and the boom of the tingling strings, pressing the poised feet of his mother, who smiles at him as she sings, yearning to belong, yearning to belong. My heart beats with a ceaseless longing, lover, yearning to belong. In spite of myself and all of these nursery songs, my heart beats with a ceaseless longing, lover, yearning to belong. Of his mother, who smiles at him as she sings, listen to me son, I'll tell you why your father's strong, 'cause he can still say every single day he's yearning to belong, yearning to belong, yearning to belong. My heart beats with ceaseless longing, lover, yearning to belong. In spite of myself and all of these nursery songs, my heart beats with the sweets with the peaceless born and something long. Sing cuckoo-doo-coo, cuckoo-doo-coo. Sing cuckoo-doo-coo, sing cuckoo-doo-coo, cuckoo-doo-coo, cuckoo-doo.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our first segment. Please join us in the second at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up for a membership and tune into the second hour of all our previous shows and all the video material that we have made over the years. And interesting and important second hour is coming up here, so definitely don't miss it. As I announced at the beginning of the show, please don't miss our Amarin live stream this weekend. More information is coming. We'll put this up on the websites here shortly. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you for listening and for your support and for staying with us.